This is Jason Wetzel, Fayetteville, North Carolina. The sound you heard was the ancient Chinese gong used by Lynn Pryor to introduce the plays at the Gilbert Theater. It is introducing this segment of what we shall call The Pryor's Tale. We are at the stoplight of Lynn Pryor's life in California. With that, I turn it over to Lynn.
Yeah, it was Lafayette, California. I had just been visiting a psychiatrist. He'd counseled me, telling me that I had to tell my wife that I was gay. It was 1976.
I was 41
years old. And I had, this really is true. I said to myself, if it's red, I'm going to stop there. Pull myself together, turn right and go home, face the music. If it's green, I'm going to sail through the stoplight, turn left and head to San Francisco and the Golden Gate Bridge. Well, it was red, thank God, and I pulled myself together, turned right, and went home and read to the boys that evening as usual, my two wonderful sons. Went to bed, was lying there stiff as a board. My wife came in and said, where were you? And then I swallowed and told her that I was gay. She was completely surprised. I somehow thought perhaps she would say something like, I always wondered or something, but no, she was completely surprised. And so we talked and talked, and at that moment, that evening, when we were lying there in bed, I can't go on like this. I have to leave. And the more we talked, I said, you can have everything. I said, the more we talked, we decided over the next couple of days that we would give a year to try to work things out, which we did. And she tried so hard, thank her, God bless her, and I did too, but the finger in the dike had failed, and the cast, the dam had broken, and I was being swept along, even though I gave my best to that year. But I think I knew in my heart that it was impossible. And yet, at the end of that year, when I realized again, freshly, every day of my life, really, with the wonderful, we'd created this wonderful family life, with a beautiful house, and I love my work, and I love having a family and being a father, and yet I was not myself. And yet, so I said to her that at the end of the year, I said, I think I'm as happy as I'm going to be. But then she said, no, I want more. And oh, I couldn't blame her. And so we began the separation, the psychological separation and the physical separation. But that very night when that decision was made, I said, I will tell the boys. This was the most difficult thing I had ever done. I thought it was going to cost me my reason, as I first asked the older one to come into the living room, and I told him. He then began walking around the house very quickly up the stairs and down the stairs, and I was following him. And I was saying, we still love you, but we need to break. We didn't talk about the main reason. And that was just horribly difficult. Then I had to turn to my younger son and tell him the same thing. But he was only 9, and I could tell he was having a hard time understanding what. So then the plan was, after I was spent some days on the sofa in the study, that I would get my own apartment. Well, I was in rehearsal for a play, George Gershwin play, Of Thee I Sing. I was in the chorus, in the ensemble. And opening night was the night that I was leaving the house, finally. I had rented an apartment in the same city. And before really going there that night, I went to my opening night of this play, of the I Sing. And in this play, the lead actress sings a song. It's a wedding scene, and she sings a song all about love and wedded bliss. And I was on stage right there. It was very hard not to cry. When the play was over, I got in my car and drove to this apartment, opened the door, and there I was, facing my new life. No warm home, no home-cooked meals, no children running up to you, no embraces, all that we had built together for those 17 years were just gone in a stroke. And the apartment was dark. I remember going around, turning on lights, looking around. It was cold. And I went to bed. Then began my life as a single dad, as a single man. At 42, I was born again. And soon I pulled myself together and said, "This is where I am now. This is my reality now. Make the best of it." Since I'm basically a happy, optimistic person, it wasn't long before I was in the swing of this single life. The boys were with me every other weekend. Then I made a big decision and decided to move to Berkeley, California. I found a wonderful apartment within this one block away from the University of California, Berkeley, one of the world's great universities. So now suddenly I was out of the suburbs, surrounded by this academic life. People in my apartment were PhDs and authors and brilliant, brilliant people. And so began this life of commuting to my library job in the interior of Contra Costa County. And there I was for 17 years. These were, in many ways, they were just wonderful years. The boys were with me for every other Sunday or as often as I could get them. We had wonderful times together. Their friends would come and visit, and they would sleep over. And my oldest son was into micro-armored battle fighting. He had shoeboxes filled with little lead tanks and different armaments. And he and his friends would spend the weekend laying out these war battles in little cities and all across the living room, and then they would fight each other, and here I'm an atheist, I'm a pacifist, not an atheist, a pacifist, and I was having to go along with these two sons, particularly the older one, who he must have been Till of the Hun in an earlier life. But his whole life was to this day, not really now, it's another career path, but he was always very big in guns. And I remember when Martin Luther King was killed, I gathered up all of their play pistols and rifles and put them in the attic in 1968. I'm backtracking. This is before I'm in Berkeley, of course. We're still a family. And that very next morning, I said, "You're not going to have any more pistols or rifles. You're not going to have them in this house." So the next morning at breakfast, he chewed his toast into the shape of a pistol and began shooting his brother with it. So I went right up to the attic and got everything down again and gave up on that. So I was with the boys when they were 9, 12, 13, and during all of those years, they were golden years. So I was able to maintain, sustain this thing known as fatherhood. Fatherhood was really the highlight of my life. I thought that I would not be able to become a father under the circumstances. But after you heard earlier and earlier episodes of our talking about the this oral history, which eventually, believe it or not, folks, is going to get to the Gilbert Theater. But this is all part of the Gilbert Theater, really, in a deep way. But I thought that I was not going to ever be a father, and this is part of the reason why, as I look at that drawing of myself done after Jim and I broke up in San Francisco State, and I realized that I was not going to have a conventional life, and that I was probably not going to be able to not be a father. And in those days, to be gay in the early 50s, it was the medieval times. You were shunned. You heard earlier that my psychiatrist was out of something, out of the Dark Ages, and was no help at all. And so as I look at this drawing and I see my eyes so troubled and angry and hurt and desolate at what was facing me. But now the optimism returns, and I now have the two sons. I'm in Berkeley, and I'm in this beautiful apartment in this world-class university city, meeting all kinds of wonderful people, and beginning to be myself sexually. I met someone that within weeks of moving to Berkeley, in coming out, a wonderful man, an architect. I've always been partial to architects. And we were together for a year. And I'm not going to go into any more than that, but it did give me great hope that there was going to be some kind of life for me. I have my boys, can perhaps find love, and even with all the roadblocks that society throws in front of us, people like me. But we broke up, and to this day I'm sorry that I wasn't more mature about that. But he was very, very jealous of the boys, and that was very difficult. And he wanted me to, in some ways, choose between him and them. And of course, that was an impossible choice, one I would never make. I felt that I could do both, but he didn't think so. But I regret what that did to him, and then I moved on. And as I said, I think in an earlier episode, that I'm not ashamed of it, but I became very promiscuous. I was making up for all of those years when I was 42 at that point, and I made up for all those years when I had to suppress and suppress and suppress and not act out on it. Except for that year with Jim in my sophomore year in college. And so the years go on. I have wonderful, wonderful times with the boys and their friends. With a church, I became very active in the historic Methodist church in Berkeley, Trinity Methodist. I started acting in a theater company called The Bear Stage. I like to think we did wonderful work there. I did a play called The Madness of Lady Bright.
And when was that?
Moving on through these years into the early 80s. AIDS had not happened yet. Lady Bright was a one-man show, and he was middle-aged, living in an unair-conditioned apartment in New York City. He was gay, he was falling apart and really going insane. And I like to think I did it well. I think I could do a better job of it now. I was in my late 40s, and it was a big challenge to play his deterioration.
Why do you think you could do a better job of it?
Well, because I'm more centered now, and I can understand him better. His name was Leslie Bright, the character. It's Lanford Wilson, really a well-known play for theater world. And I got a standing ovation opening night, but I still think I could do a better job now because of my experience and my understanding. And I would love Leslie Bright now, where at the time I just felt sorry for him. But now I would love him with a deep, much deeper understanding of what he had been going through in the days of his time, in the 40s and 50s and so on. But one of the nice things about growing old is that we can grow wiser. You know, I am ending the first segment of our theater stories now, the last couple of weeks, asking this question of our guests. What is the universal question? And I'm very tempted to answer it right now, but I'm not going to, because I promised everyone in the other portion of our show that I'll answer it in the future when I feel the time is right. But you're going to find that the answer to that question is the answer to what I was, Mary's handing me some Kleenex. What it's really, really all about. And I think we all know what it is, but I'm not going to talk about it now. I don't want to steal my thunder for the future. But there we are. I'm acting in plays. After the architect and I broke up, I began dating a series of fellas.
This is in the early 80s. Early 1980s.
I wasn't in my age yet.
No, I mean the early 1980s.
Yes. And so marvelous people that I met at that time. I joined something called K Fathers. There was a center, of course, Berkeley, very progressive community, and they had, where most communities were doing nothing for gays in those days, that Berkeley had a place where we could go, gay fathers could go, and have someone that would meet with us and listen to us about our problems and our challenges. And we would share, and it was just. It really saved my life. I mean, not my life, but it helped me to see that there were other people like myself, men who were fathers. And we met in these discussion groups. We also had fun times and go out to parties and so on. Remember, that was the night that we had bought our children. I brought my older son to that one. And he and a group of us went up there and sang. We did a little show, and we sang the song, I saw Daddy kissing Santa Claus. we had a lot of fun. But I remember my son saying at that time, he said, gays should not have children. I said, and where would you be, my friend, right now if I hadn't? It's true that I went back. I went back and forth on that. But I thank God I was able, even though it was very, very painful. Those 17 years in the marriage, there was. I'd be so careful. I wore dark glasses during those years. Frequently, even when the sun wasn't out, it was overcast, but I didn't want anybody seeing where I was looking. It was those kinds of games you played, even though I did not. I was not faithless. I was faithful the whole time, all 17 of those years. But of course, your mind, in the Jimmy Carter sense, remember that poor Jimmy got into so much trouble. He said that he did not ever, was never unfaithful to his wife, but he sinned in his mind many, many times. Well, and that's, I can certainly understand that. Anyway, back to the Berkeley years. They were wonderful years, seeing the boys grow up. It was wonderful weekends when their friends would come over, and there were times when the kids would just be in sleeping bags in the living room floor, and I'd get out of my bedroom and step over all these bodies and go into the kitchen and make 500 pancakes so I really, those wonderful times with being a father continued. It wasn't in a house in the suburbs with a wife, but it was, we made it just, I like to think. Then my older son graduated from high school, entered the Army, where he was to have a good, very good career.
And what year was this?
I forget. But he had 2 years of college and decided to go into the Army. My other son stayed with me. By this time, both boys had been living with me full time for a couple of several years. I failed to mention that. At some point, they both decided to come live with me full time. Then, during this time, when my son was in the Army, he met someone